Lecture 35, The Chivalrous Society.
Hello and welcome once again to our series of lectures on the foundations of Western civilization. This time, lecture number 35, which I've entitled The Chivalrous Society. In our last lecture, we talked about the material conditions of Europe in the High Middle Ages, a period I characterized with the word expansion. Now what we're going to turn to is the human side. Who were the people? Last time we said there were lots more of them and that they got a lot more prosperous, but who were they? So now let's meet a few people. Mostly, alas, in large groups, but nevertheless, at least we've now put a human face on Europe in this period. King Alfred the Great of England in the late 9th century once said that a kingdom needed men who fought, men who prayed, and men who worked. About a century later, two French bishops, one in prose, one in poetry, picked up that same theme and talked about a world of oratores, prayers, bellatores, fighters, and laboratores, workers. So it was a fairly well-anchored notion in Europe that there would be these three classes of people. Now, there were conflicts among these groups as to which ones were the natural leaders of society, exactly what roles these groups would play in this particular society. And it's also important to say that this tripartite scheme of those who fight, those who work, and those who pray leaves some people out. For example, town people. They don't actually fit. And yet, in our last lecture, we saw that one of the most dynamic features of Europe in the High Middle Ages was the emergence of towns. And yet, to work was to work the soil, not to work, for example, in a town. It left other people out, too. It left minorities out. It was very clear that this was a militantly Christian society. So Jews, for example, were not to be enumerated in these three classes. Women were rather ambiguously attached to this society because they weren't really the fighters. They weren't really in the first place understood to be the prayers. And although many women worked, they weren't in the first place understood to be the workers. So the scheme that we're going to use to build this lecture, those who work, those who fight, those who pray, is indeed a medieval one, so it has a certain authenticity, but it also has certain limitations. Let's begin with those who fight. That is to say, with the warrior class of Europe, that is to say, with the nobility. The nobility in the earlier Middle Ages tended to consist of very large, loosely structured families who held large tracts of land, who monopolized public offices, who tended to intermarry within their particular group, who tended to have very close relationships to royal families, and indeed, royal families were simply the most distinctive of these aristocratic families. By the 11th century, we begin to see some interesting and important changes in the basic shape of families. First of all, they begin to practice primogeniture. Primus genitus in Latin means firstborn. That's also masculine. It's not prima genita, which would be the firstborn daughter. It focuses on the firstborn son. Increasingly, families were handing their lands, their titles, offices they possessed, to a firstborn son. Now, these families also then began to form themselves into what we call lineages. They began to trace their ancestry fundamentally on the male side. Now, that was quite different. In the world of Charlemagne, for example, families traced their lineage on both the male and the female side. You were as likely to talk about, to praise your distinguished female ancestors as your distinguished male ancestors. But now, in the High Middle Ages, the world is becoming, we might say, relentlessly male. And it's focusing more and more on firstborn sons. Now, when offices, titles, provisions, landed endowments, and so on were not provided to second or third or fourth or fifth or sixth or however many sons there might be, and remember we said in our last lecture that family sizes are now larger, a considerable number of aristocratic young men are cut loose in this society. They now have to fend for themselves. Well, some of them go into towns, for example. Some of them, as we'll see in a few minutes, go into the clergy, for example. But a great many of these young men went off to the frontiers of Europe to fight there and to make their way, to make careers for themselves. If we think of the crusading movement and the armies of crusaders. Here is the basic source for all of those soldiers who went off on crusade. Partly fired, yes, by religious imagination, but also fired by opportunity, sort of out on the frontier.